When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hi, everyone. This is Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast affiliated with the New Eastern Europe magazine based in Krakow, Poland. My name is Adam Reichert. I am the editor-in-chief of the magazine, and with me is our co-host, Maciek Makulski, a contributing editor to New Eastern Europe. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam, and hello, everyone. I think I can start with a special announcement, let's call it like that, because for those who are listening to us for the first time, we can reveal that usually we record everything online. Each episode is recorded online because I am based in Warsaw and Adam is based in Krakow. So this is a really virtual project for us. But today, the geographical distance between us is even bigger than usual because Adam is now in the United States, and that's not very surprising, I guess, that American is in the United States, but Adam, I know that you're there on study visit, you're doing some research there on disinformation, and
yes,
especially Russian disinformation in Europe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the project, what you're doing there, where are you?
Sure. I'm here in Chicago right now. I was awarded this year a Transatlantic Media Fellowship by the Heinrich Bulle Foundation, the Warsaw office. So I'm one of three people who are based in Poland, journalists based in Poland, who get to come to the US and do some research on certain topics. And the topic that I'm researching, two topics actually. One is looking at the role of Russian disinformation in American politics, and particularly researching how locals in more in the Midwest cities see this as an issue, if they see it at all. I've had some very interesting discussions. I've so far been in St. Louis, and now I'm in Chicago. And the second topic that I'm researching is American support for multilateral cooperation, defense cooperation, mostly NATO, and how Americans see participation in NATO, considering the current international environment, as well as politics in the U.S. So it's been so far very interesting. I have one interesting announcement for the podcast as well. I will be visiting the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which is based here in Chicago, and I will have an interview with the director, who is the previous U.S. ambassador to NATO. And I'm recording it for the podcast, so keep an eye out for that. We'll have this special interview for the podcast coming soon.
That all sounds very interesting, and to me, these are two very big topics. So I'm curious what will be the result. Can we expect any kind of report or article? For sure, we'll talk about it in the podcast. But yeah. Can you say something more?
Yeah, I plan to have a lot of results. So there will be a couple articles in Polish media, in Polish, but I also will have in New Eastern Europe an article, as well as maybe another interview, which I'm looking at doing later this week, which may also be on New Eastern Europe. So I'll make sure to let all of our listeners know and our readers of New Eastern Europe What are the results, and where they can get more information and access some of these materials.
That's great. And maybe one more question regarding this disinformation topic, because a couple months ago, we, as you remember for sure, we had very interesting episode on disinformation. Our guest was Jakub Kolinski from Atlantic Council. Those listeners who are interested in, you can easily find this episode on our website. But I remember that we talked that time very much also about how to counter disinformation and what are the roles for different types of agencies or actors or even for civil society, as you like to say. And I'm interesting that you are now focusing more on the measures and tools Russia is using in preparing disinformation campaigns, or you also address this topic of countering disinformation.
I actually my research is more for, I don't want to give too much away, so I want everyone to be anticipating it, but my research is focusing largely on awareness, and I've surprisingly found that in this part of the U.S. is very different. And that's why I actually wanted to come to the Midwest, because we know what the attitudes are on the East Coast, especially in D.C. Jakub Kolinski, as you mentioned, who we interviewed, he's in Prague, but he's with the Atlantic Council. They do a lot of work on disinformation, but a lot of that awareness doesn't get in towards the middle of the country. And it's been very interesting to learn how less aware people are of these kind of campaigns. So I'm looking largely at social awareness and social attitudes. Do they see it as a threat, as a problem? This is the angle that I'm looking at.
Sounds really interesting. So I'm not asking you for more details.
As you said, coming soon.
It should come as a surprise for listeners, for readers, for our supporters. Okay, so thanks for that. And I suggest moving to the main part of our today's episode.
Yep, sounds good. Maybe before we begin, Maciek, let's just remind our listeners that we are currently fundraising for supporting this podcast. As our listeners hopefully know, that this podcast is a 100% volunteer activity of myself and Maciek. All of the equipment that we have is donated by ourselves. We are affiliated with the New Eastern Europe magazine, but we do not have any additional project funding for it. So if you want to support the podcast, please check out the link, which will be it'll be below. But you can also visit www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And you can choose the amount of money you'd like to donate. And we're currently raising some money to invest in equipment for production of the podcast. So really, your support will go a long way to help with that.
Yes. Please do consider a donation. Every little bit helps. And it's also really good feedback for us that you like what we are doing here. I think one more thing to add, I think, is that we try also to reward our
That's
supporters
right.
with different things. But you can read about different plans of supporting and rewards for these plans in the description at patreon.com/talkeastern-europe. So once again, we appreciate all your support.
Maciek, it's hard to believe that we're already on episode 15. We're nearing a total of 8,000 downloads, which I think is not bad for a podcast that has been around for 6 months. If you haven't heard, for our listeners who haven't heard our recent episodes, I do suggest that you also check them out. The most recent episode that we did was an interview with Anna Korbut, who is a fellow at the Chatham House, on the political developments in Ukraine. And we tried to get a better understanding of what direction that country is going, especially with the new politics and the new president, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Yes, that was very very interesting conversation. And we have also some plans for the upcoming episode as well. But today we are focusing on a country that has not really been at the headlines recently. Azerbaijan. And as our listeners for sure know, Azerbaijan is one of the Eastern Partnership countries. This is one of the reasons why it is so interesting also for us. And I think that in general, in upcoming episodes, we will try to grasp as many voices from Eastern Partnership countries as possible to give here the voice from the region about the future of Eastern Partnership. This is a question actually which we try to ask every expert from each Eastern Partnership countries we have occasion to interview. So I'm glad that today we will touch this issue in conversation with guests from Azerbaijan.
Yeah, and we were very lucky to have our guests come to Poland. They both recently they set up an independent think tank in Baku, and they aim to try to facilitate a global dialogue with Azerbaijan, with Azerbaijanis, and with people outside who are interested in the region. So we talk a little bit about that. And Maciek, if you don't mind, I'll set up the interview before we go into it. A couple issues I want to cover and introduce our guests.
Yes, please go ahead.
We had them here in Poland a couple weeks ago as part of a study visit, and Maciek, you also met them in Warsaw. And they were participants in a seminar that we organized in the city of Wrocław, which was actually looking at the future of the Eastern Partnership. So it was very nice to have them participate in that discussion. They're both experts on issues like geopolitics, security cooperation, these kind of issues. And so I just want to, so the listeners understand, in order for them to be open and honest on their discussions, we tried to keep it particularly to the issues that they are most interested and expert on, and that includes the relations with Europe. We talk a lot about the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and the social issues related to that, as well as relations with Armenia in this context, and the role that Russia plays in the South Caucasus. So there's a lot of issues that we talk about. We do not talk about human rights issues. I felt that this was not an issue that they were experts on or wanting to talk about, but I do think that this is the issue of human rights in Azerbaijan is an important issue, and we will come back to that, I think, in the future as well.
So I think it was important disclaimer. My impression after the conversation with Rusif and Murat from Baku was that they are a young team, still trying to find the main focus, but this is very interesting how capable they are to cover very broad issues from the region, about the region. So I think now we can just listen to the interview.
Pete Rose logged more hits in baseball history than anyone else. No one has come close to breaking his record. But he was also at the center of one of the game's biggest scandals, a scandal that changed baseball forever. In the new book, Charlie Hustle, New York Times bestselling author Keith O'Brien chronicles Pete Rose's spectacular rise and fall. Drawing on firsthand interviews with Rose himself and his associates, this is Pete Rose as we've never seen him before. By Charlie Hustle, available wherever books are sold.
With me here is Rusif Huseynov and Murad Muradov, who are the co-founders of the Top Chubashov Center based in Baku, Azerbaijan, visiting here in Poland for a few events, including an event on the Eastern Partnership. Gentlemen, welcome to our podcast, and thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much, Adam. It's an honor to be here. So I hope we'll have an interesting discussion today.
Great. So let me start with a question about the Eastern Partnership, since that is one of the reasons why you came here to Poland. And maybe give us a brief understanding of what is Azerbaijan's relationship now with the European Union, considering that it is not one of the three states that have signed association agreements or deep and comprehensive free trade agreements. How would you characterize the current relations between Azerbaijan and the European Union, and also in the framework of the Eastern Partnership?
Thanks for the question, Adam. It is indeed an interesting topic, because Azerbaijan holds a unique position among six Eastern Partnership countries. Unlike Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine, which have set European integration as their foreign policy priority, and unlike Armenia and Belarus, which are formally within the pro-Russian camp, Azerbaijan has rather a neutral position without showing any sign of joining either bloc. That's why I would characterize Azerbaijan's relations with the Eastern, with the European Union or within Eastern Partnership project rather as cooperation, not integration.
Mm-hmm.
If you want, further in our conversation, we can go more into details.
Mm-hmm. And there has been some movement to develop a strategic cooperation agreement, I believe, right? And what is the current status of, with the cooperation agreement between the European Union and Azerbaijan?
The first agreement was signed in 1999, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, it's almost 20 years have passed. And it has been an understanding recently that the agreement is outdated and it does not fit the current position of Azerbaijan, I mean, its role in the vis-à-vis the European Union and its interests. That's why the, recently work on the new agreement intensified. And, I would say there have been several positive signs since last year, and particularly in April this year, the EU Foreign Affairs Commissioner, Madame Mogherini, she explicitly said that the agreement is on the final stage of completion,
mm-hmm.
and it's supposed to be ready in a couple of months or mm-hmm. maybe even more. Adding that, inshallah, I mean, if God permits,
yes.
it will be down and dusted.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, probably currently is. There are reasons for positive expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Let me add some more moments.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the EU and Azerbaijan launched relevant negotiations on association agreement in 2010. However, 3 years later, the negotiations stopped as the Azerbaijani side said it was no more interested
mm-hmm.
in this type of agreement and instead offered a new kind of deal, which the Azerbaijani party has labeled as a strategic agreement,
mm-hmm.
Strategic partnership agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And the negotiations around this new type of agreement started in early 2017, I guess. And according to the latest news, 90% of the agreement is done.
Mm-hmm.
Both parties hoped the signing process could have happened before the European elections, but obviously they couldn't make it. So we'll probably have to wait until new European authorities
mm-hmm.
Are formed.
Right.
And probably the signing will happen afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, in general, if we talk about Azerbaijan's participation in Eastern Partnership, there's a lot of criticism that the Eastern Partnership is a challenging policy because the six members are very different. How would you say overall, is it positive that Azerbaijan has been participating in Eastern Partnership? Or would you actually suggest that maybe bilateral relations with the EU more than multilateral plus bilateral, as the Eastern Partnership is somewhat designed in this way?
Well, I believe Eastern Partnership, the former ENP,
the European Neighborhood Policy,
European Neighborhood Policy, is designed to fit local demands of each member, individual state, because the former project had a one fits all formula, which was not acceptable in many cases. As I understand, Azerbaijan still prefers bilateral relations,
mm-hmm.
with putting more emphasis on energy and transport cooperation,
mm-hmm.
Without showing any interest in deepening further integration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So rather just strategic cooperation, but no integration.
Probably yes. At this stage, this is seeming the main foreign policy goal of mm-hmm. Azerbaijani government.
But I would add also to this comment that on one hand, yes, Azerbaijan, because of its very specific economic condition, it's an energy exporter and quite an important one for the EU too. And because of its strategic location, it perceives its relations with the EU differently than most other members.
Mm-hmm.
But still, Azerbaijani government has been always explicitly interested in supporting this multilateral format. And there are a couple of reasons for that. Well, first of all, it makes sense for Azerbaijan to kind of stand together with several different members, let's say, and some countries like Georgia and Ukraine, Belarus, which Azerbaijan has very good relationships,
mm-hmm.
and obviously, in some matters, they kind of support each other, and it makes hard negotiation process with the EU easier in some aspects, and also, there is an important issue for Azerbaijan, as you know, it's Armenia. And
right.
Azerbaijan would not be interested to kind of fall outside the framework where Armenia is within. And so to be able to kind of always balance its place and to be able to trace, let's say, also the Armenian's role within the policy better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that, I think, to the relations with Armenia in a moment. But I did want to ask also about what is the kind of a general Azerbaijani attitude, not from the elite's perspective, but just general attitudes towards Europe and EU? How do they see Azerbaijan? Do they feel part of Europe, or is it more? I don't know. We know that Azerbaijan and Turkey have very close relations. How would you kind of characterize?
As for popular public narrative, mm-hmm. in Azerbaijan towards the towards Europe or the West in general has been generally positive.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, our society is constructing Azerbaijan as a Western and secular state. It is imagining Azerbaijan is a Western country.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are certainly some topics, not all European values and norms may comply with like Oriental, Islamic, or Caucasian elements in Azerbaijani mentality. But it's a broader topic, so let's not go into details. I remember as a schoolboy first, and then as a student at the turn of the century, especially in the late 90s and early 21st century, there was big optimism,
mm-hmm.
in Azerbaijani society that our country would soon become part of the European family.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Azerbaijan joined many European political institutions, sporting associations. And I remember how the admission Azerbaijan's admission to the Council of Europe in 2001, I guess, was celebrated as a historic event in Azerbaijan. And it was a sign that we are now part of this European family. However, over the years, the public has been disillusioned,
mm-hmm.
a bit disappointed, due to several factors, because again, the main issue in Azerbaijani society remains the Nagorno-Karabakh problem.
Mm-hmm.
Having not received any tangible support from the Western countries. The Azerbaijani society does not like this vague position of individual European countries or the European Union in general towards this issue. Plus, we saw how Georgia, Professor Georgia,
mm-hmm.
was left alone vis-a-vis Russia in 2008. And then in 2014, Ukraine became another victim of the Russian aggression, probably due to their pro-Western policies. In this context, Azerbaijani society would opt for a balancing policy in order not to irritate Russia and in order to see how the European Union will start showing solid support to those countries which really want to join the Western,
mm-hmm.
Western family.
Mm-hmm.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Talk about Nagorno-Karabakh and the conflict there. We recently saw a big change in Armenia with the revolution, and some we in fact had Richard Girgozian on our podcast a couple episodes ago, and I mean he was optimistic, but he had no specifics and was not very certain in what direction it would go. He was hoping that dialogue was going to happen next. That's been a couple months already. How do you assess? Is there any hope with the change in Armenia, or is it is this kind of a conflict that's going to be so difficult to solve that one small change like in Armenia would not make a difference?
Exactly a year ago, I was talking to Mr. Lawrence Brewers, who's a kind of famous expert on the problem, on general South Caucasus politics. I mean, he runs the Janet House. So, I was actually discussing with him the matters, related to this new Armenian government and what can be its position towards the Karabakh issue and in general what to expect. So, and he, as a frequent traveler to, say, both kind of country and as originally Armenia, he kind of makes a lot of observations. And so, in a rather pessimistic fashion was like the Armenian society in the last decade has grown much less kind of tolerant and say, much less supportive of an idea of even kind of, returning the, say, so-called adjacent regions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if my son may not know the details, beyond the Nagorno-Karabakh Republic, like the Autonomous Republic, which which is also occupied, the Armenian forces in 1993-94 also occupied, say, seven regions, which are just kind of surrounded. It's kind of, as a so-called buffer zone, mm-hmm. which they, like, hold as a kind of a territorial hostage. And it's basically down the regions where there is almost no economic activity, no kind of settlements, kind of just burnt land. And approximately 15 years ago, there was a consensus in among the Armenian elite and kind of say the so the Mainstay of society. I mean, these regions are not Armenians in the end, so and they will be returned. I mean, but now this kind of this thinking has waned. I mean, and it's substituted by a more aggressive approach. Mm. So kind of giving nothing in no acre of land.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's actually brings me to like a conclusion that the major problem here is that the societies, I mean, in Armenia, like especially, well, is much more probably radical than the government.
Mm-hmm.
And well, in the in this regard, well, also, well, I think that the Pashinyan, I mean, the people he brought to power are in themselves are probably more, let's say, more inclined maybe to talks, to negotiations, they're kind of more modern, they're not kind of seem to be kind of, don't seem to have this militaristic legacy in their kind of upbringing. I mean, they didn't fight in the, obviously, in the Karabakh. But the problem is that, well, as he proposed to be a democratic leader, and he does not have resources and connections enough to install himself as a more kind of strongman, like leader, so he has to kind of to I would say to obey to this public opinion and to the general mood,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we see well one day he meets his President Aliyev and they talk and they kind of agree on say on the kind of. Better border control, and indeed, for several months there have been much less skirmishes than there used to be in the previous years. But then, something happens within the country. I mean, some opposition forces kind of blame him in kind of in being a loser and conducting an anti kind of patriotic policy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he suddenly goes to Karabakh and makes quite like violent and militaristic statements, and this kind of tends to invalidate all the kind of small, I mean, successes that have been like achieved like, previously.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's in my opinion is the main problem, which makes unlikely the, I mean, any serious progress in the like nearest future.
Mm-hmm.
I will add some more nuances on my side.
Mm-hmm.
A few months ago, the foreign ministers of both countries announced they would start preparing their populaces for peace. Of course,
yeah, I remember.
Yes, it led to many discussions and speculations on what kind of measures would be taken in order to prepare these two hostile societies. But so far, we haven't seen any measures, any tangible measures or actions in this direction. Moreover, a few days back, an Azerbaijani officer was shot by an Armenian sniper on the front line, which shows the situation is still at the worst level,
mm-hmm.
And with no positive sign to be seen, like at the end of the tunnel. Of course, the negotiations are being held as always. The usually both parties, as well as the mediators, call on for more dialogue, for more activity in this direction. Sometimes they may announce some positive changes, but overall, as Murat just said, I don't think there are big perspectives for positive changes in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
And I will also like to add a couple of things. Well, and not only to sound any kind of conspiracies, but what happens in Armenia also brings me to think that. There are very strong lobbies in some of the country, which are against any kind of progress, which kind of strive on the current status quo and this constant tension. And, most probably they can be found within the armed forces, I don't know. The thing that, happened lately, I mean, namely this, the killing of an Azerbaijani officer, which also kind of provoked this quite a hard rebuke from the Azerbaijani side.
Mm-hmm.
And, this kind of provocation, and the latest militaristic statements were made very soon after, the Minsk group, the OSCE and other international observers, they kind of praise the country's efforts, and they kind of they mentioned that the recent 6 months have seen much less, I mean, almost no victims on the like front line. I mean, and as soon as the small success was peddled, I mean, the new problems arose. And well, it, I mean, bringing again to conclusion that I mean, the government, let's say, cannot fully, let's say, control all these, I mean, forces that, I mean, vitally interested in warmongering and in peddling kind of aggressive attitude towards Azerbaijan as, say, most Vivendi of Armenian politics.
And so it's not very optimistic, for the moment, at least, perspective in terms of the resolving the conflict with the change in Armenia, you would say, yeah?
Well, I would say the narrative from the Armenian side became more militaristic and nationalistic because just a day after when the foreign ministers agreed for this, preparing the populations for peace formula, the Armenian defense minister stated his country could occupy even more territories from Azerbaijan. This type of narrative, these type of statements, of course, echo in Azerbaijani society as well, and people in Azerbaijan also become more hostile and demand the government answer at least in such a manner.
Right. I remember it was 2016 in April, right, when the conflict kind of heated up again. There's always a risk, I guess, that this could. This could happen again, or even escalate.
Yes, that is true. Although I don't believe a very big war would break out, but small-scale skirmishes, operations, the risk of such small-scale skirmishes are always there. I don't exclude them.
So if we kind of bring back the 2016 conflict in memory, well, we will see that after like 4 days of very intense like battles and shootings, the foreign ministers and the defense ministers of Azerbaijan and Armenia were summoned to Russia. I mean, it was in Russia that they agreed to kind of a new ceasefire and to install end the let's say the hostilities. I mean the hot bar. And I'll say this event once more emphasized that, I mean, well, Russia as a main kind of power in this part of the world, which is kind of has been in kind of see viewing itself as in charge of the region. Well, it is not interested at all in kind of in any kind of decisive changes, and so and that's why. Well, I would say the Azerbaijani government would not kind of risk any kind of resumption of something. I mean, unless something really extraordinary happens. And for Armenia, it's not rational. I mean, bearing in mind that they occupied even more than they initially hoped for. So, they're happy to, to take it and to. Basically.
And I mean, you bring up the role of Russia, which is a strategic partner for Armenia, and especially in this conflict. Do you see Russia playing some sort of role? And I mean, in terms of the Nagorno-Karabakh, not a positive role. I imagine that it's probably playing much more of a negative role. But
if I generalize Russia's role in all these so-called frozen conflicts across the post-Soviet countries or across the Guam countries, because like Georgia, Moldova and Ukraine, Azerbaijan suffers from almost the same type of territorial problem. In my opinion, Russia would be interested in prolonging these status quo. Neither war nor peace. Because any hostilities, any conflicts which can break out in these breakaway regions may risk Russia's interests. At the same time, the current status quo would always be an obstacle for the further development of the parent states or their westward integration.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I believe Russia would be interested in keeping those conflicts as they are now.
Rather frozen.
Although the Nagorno-Karabakh skirmishes in 2016 show that they're not so frozen.
Mm-hmm.
They're active and they're hot.
Right.
I would add it's kind of half frozen.
Half frozen.
Yeah, so kind of it's, I mean, it's frozen enough not to kind of permit a big conflict outbreak, but at the same time, they're always keeping both countries in tension.
Mm.
And they actually each have enormous resources. I mean, well, billions of money which could have been invested in the kind of economic development. Well, they have to be kind of spent on, say, on arming. And actually, acquiring Russian arms and weapons is also quite a big, I mean, issue for both governments. And I mean, spent kind of, I would say, has no more than $2 billion in the last recent years for the purchases of weapons from Russia only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually it's good business as well for Russia. Why don't you guys tell us a bit about your think tank? What is the background from it? What do you aim to do with it? And what's next for you guys?
Mm-hmm. Murad and I had an idea 3 or 4 years ago to establish an online platform,
mm-hmm,
where students, recent graduates, and young researchers would simply share their articles and essays. And until that time, we hadn't had such a platform in Azerbaijan, an English language platform, mm-hmm, in Azerbaijan. So it became quite popular, both in our country and even beyond, because we started receiving pieces even from young authors from different countries. Later, showing the demand, plus with the aim to turn Azerbaijan into a regional hub of research, we decided to establish this think tank, which we named after Alimardan Bey Topchubashov, Azerbaijani foreign minister who led Azerbaijan delegation Paris Peace Conference in 1919. Our aim is to be an independent research center,
mm-hmm,
which would provide the domestic audience with normal analysis, because Azerbaijan is sitting at an uneasy neighborhood. We are at the crossroads of civilizations. We are squeezed by Russia, Turkey, Iran. The Eastern Europe and Middle East are our neighboring regions, plus China and the United States are very much interested in this area. So this is an interesting place. We have to give normal analysis to our audience, Azerbaijani audience, about what's happening around us. Moreover, we also aim to provide reports, analysis to external parties who are interested in this region, because of our geostrategic location, our country in general, we can study the likes of Russia, Turkey, Iran, and provide most detailed information, reports to external parties. This was our aim. Of course, there are huge problems with different issues, starting with financing, of course, finding qualified staff is another problem. Finding people who would share our vision is another problem. But we have to admit that our own experience is also not that big. We have to learn ourselves also. But it is a challenging endeavor. We are very happy that we started all this project. We'll learn ourselves and we'll try to share our knowledge, our information with all interested parties.
Right. Yeah, and well, so I think OSIF has provided quite a like a wide, extensive explanation of our mission and what they are supposed to do. Well, I would add also some points about about the problems which, I mean, social science in general has in all, I'd say, post-Soviet countries. Because, I mean, basically, kind of for 70 years, we were kind of living under the strict ideological control of, like, so-called Marxism-Leninism, which, it was supposed to have only one truth, let's say, and any kind of alternative social, like, political, economic ideas were prohibited. So we cannot fully discuss it, and I mean the culture of discussion. I mean, in this part of the world, is shockingly low. I would say, and for many, let's say, probably Westerners, it's a little bit difficult to understand. I mean, because they kind of more accustomed to, let's say, a more sophisticated analysis and expertise. And it was a big problem for our policymaking too, because I mean, there were people with experience who could negotiate, could deal with foreign leaders, diplomats, but there were very few people able to have a broad outlook and to understand where the things were going to. And also, I would say, there was little attention to details, the subtleties of different foreign countries as origin deals with. And that's why, well, I think it's kind of keeps, very often it's prevents Azerbaijan from achieving best results in the national arena. And that's was one of the motivations which kind of led us to pursue our goal, pursue it actively. And also, of course, this lack of another kind of strong expertise is also adversely affects the perception of like foreign powers for the region. Because, I mean, sometimes they get distorted view, very simplified and kind of primitive view of this politics and the society of the country, and it's tend to say it oversimplify and not to care about the details which are very important. Say if it is the Karabakh issue, which is very sensitive, but still, I mean, unfortunately, many, I would say, foreign politicians can, I mean, don't appreciate enough well its role for the our policy making. That's why we would like to be a bridge for, like, say, the Republic to know much more about the world and to understand it much better, and vice versa, like, for the foreign countries to learn about Azerbaijan and about the region.
Great. Well, I wish you guys luck.
Thank you so much.
And we will definitely have a link in the notes from the podcast. So I do encourage everyone else to take a look at what you guys are doing, and wish you all the best.
Great. I appreciate your support, and we've been known each other for some time already, and I really hope our cooperation will thrive and be more productive in the future.
Same here. And thanks, guys, for joining us for the podcast.
Thank you so much, Adam. It was a pleasure, and I hope you also satisfied.
Absolutely. It's a great discussion. Thanks, guys.
That was an interview with Rusif Huseinov and Murat Muradov of the Tukchubashov Center from Baku. If you are interested in learning more, we'll share a link to their project in the notes below.
Yes, and as we heard in the interview, there are a lot of issues in Azerbaijan and the region of the South Caucasus. And I think it'll be interesting to continue to follow this part of the world as well. So as we record this podcast, a very interesting and important situation is unfolding in Georgia, where we've seen mass protests against the ruling coalition and with a strong anti-Russian feel to it. So I think this is something we are also keeping our eye on. There's a lot that happens in our region. Moldova is another country where there's been a lot of changes, and it's been challenging to catch up. But we do have some plans to cover these issues as well. And I suggest also checking out the website of the New Eastern Europe, which is www.neweasterneurope.eu, which also has a lot of updates and current information from the region.
Thank you all for listening us. As I said before, we appreciate all your feedback, so feel free to share our opinions or suggestions what we should do better or more, or what topics are interesting for you. And until next time.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.